and he's made a special effort to get here. He had to leave Brazil, São Paulo, very early in bad weather. And he was hoping to reach Rio and be received by the sun shining, and particularly Dr. Nagy, who was so hoping to see the sun on Copacabana and Ipanema Beach. But unfortunately, we couldn't. 3 weeks ago, I was in Alexandria, and we talked a lot about this. And I so wanted to show him the beautiful Brazilian sunshine. And I'd also like to thank Claudio Menezes, a colleague at UNESCO. We've had a lot of discussion about this project, particularly the one that we're presenting here, and also the important issue of multilingualism on the internet, because it was him 2 years ago at the first meeting that we held in Geneva, where UNESCO, with UNESCO, it was the UIT, it was the co-organizer of this forum, and this was when multilingualism was first raised after the World Summit on Internet Governance. So it's a great pleasure to be here, surrounded by friends and colleagues. We are embarking on a great adventure, which is a big challenge for everybody. It's a challenge that we are facing even here at this forum. It's a challenge which arises from the context of the modern world, of our civilization, which brings together all peoples, all civilizations, all cultures, and such diverse cultures that clash as they meet, and also clash because of the challenges that they face. And so this is why multilingualism on the internet is being presented as one of the big modern issues. And I want to talk about this particularly from the perspective of thinking about next year, because next year the UN has, called next year is going to be the year of multilingualism, 2008, a year to discuss multilingualism. So what's the internet doing, and what's this forum doing? We're throwing a stone into the water, and the ripples are spreading out. And the challenge of multilingualism is gaining other shapes and forms that didn't exist in the past. And the National Assembly of the General Assembly of the UN is preparing this program for next year. It's going to be for the whole year, and this is being coordinated by the UNESCO. This is the year of the whole year is going to be organized by UNESCO to raise awareness of multilingualism throughout the year. That is why it's so important to clearly define what multilingualism is, especially when we think about multilingualism on the internet. Multilingualism and the use of all the modern tools on the internet. Claudio Menezes knows very clearly about what multilingualism on cyberspace is, but this afternoon, for example, from 12:30 till 2, we had Professor Nagy and myself and Professor Ronaldo. We watched a seminar on the floor above where multilingualism was still defined for the internet as if it was whether you should have would have the right characters for different languages or the right accents. And this seems to be the biggest problem for the internet. And when, in fact, multilingualism on the internet is is different and much more profound problem, because multilingualism is multilingualism of content, content which can be and should be made available in each country's and each person's language. And each person should be able to have access to that information in their own language. And this is what we're talking about, and this is what we plan to do with our project. So I'd like to say a few words in general about this technology, which is a digital technology which is designed to make it easier to gain access to content expressed in each language, each natural language, and make it possible for other languages to have access in other languages to the content generated in a different language. This is what we're talking about, and I'm going to present in very general terms our initiative, our main aims, and my two colleagues are going to go into depth a little bit about the technology, how it works, and Professor Nagy will talk about how information, particularly bibliographical information, can be multilingualized by means of these systems. So the situation is changing all the time. And I have slides in English, but here they are in Portuguese. Anyway, we're still in an age where we were concerned initially about hardware, then we were all concerned about software, and then connectivity, and now we're thinking more about content, and in the future it will be communication, interactive communication. So it's a knowledge-based society. Interactive communication means that each person can use their own language and technology and media to communicate with other people, be it via the internet or television or other means, so that they can access multiple sources of knowledge. So I'm going to talk about three topics here. First is the challenges of our time as far as multilingualism on the internet is concerned. Digital representation of knowledge, which is generated in the 6,000 natural languages that are still active on the earth, and then how to gain access to this universal knowledge. The challenges of our time, first of all, the first challenge is access to knowledge. I remember in the 80s and the 90s we used to talk about access, but in a much different meaning. We talked about access to knowledge at the time, and at that time I was in the UN, at the University of the UN, and there was a controversy between two winners of the Nobel Prize in sciences. There was Watson, who had just been expelled from Harvard because of his racist comments, and then the other one was Sir John Kenji, who was the president of my board, the Institute of Advanced Studies in Tokyo. And the conflict arose because Watson proposed to the US that they should provide their researchers with access to Japanese researchers to American access, because Japan was quicker to move from lab to industrial process, the bench scale to industrial scale. And it was in this period that Japan moved forward, particularly in its technologies, its car manufacturing, and in a number of other industries. So access to knowledge became a big controversy in the 1980s and 90s, and then it diminished a bit, and now it's back. But the big question now is, what do we want to access? Access information produced by whom? So what information produced by other people do we want to incorporate? So at the time we thought, and we still think, that was it access to universal information. What is universal information? Everybody has information to knowledge, access to knowledge, and the knowledge of everybody. So it's not just knowledge which is filtered, and it's very easy to filter information. All you need to do is to go into these huge databases and certain source search mechanisms, and then you'll get your filtered information, but it's not interesting information. There may be political reasons for this, or commercial reasons. But anyway, so if universal access to information is one of our challenges, then the other is preservation of cultural diversity. And so we're talking about multilingual content and other topics that have to do with cultural diversity, as well as the preservation and the promotion of diversity. And the whole idea of the information society through this collective movement in the UN and governments leads to the idea that we must create means to make it possible to have universal access, as previously defined, means for multilingual content, and the technological infrastructure doesn't exist. It exists in terms of network, it exists in terms of connectivity, but technology for access to knowledge expressed in characters or languages which are not the dominant ones, this technology needs to be developed. So what we're proposing is an infrastructure that provides access not only to these languages, but also that allows interactivity between languages. So I'm listing one by one a few of the languages. These are the official languages in the United Nations. And every time somebody gives a talk from the representative of the Arab world, gives a presentation in the UN, he has to convert it to other languages to be distributed. This is an obligation. In practice, if it's in Arabic, it will probably not be produced in these. Only very important ones are translated. This is for economic reasons. The same applies to Chinese. In English, it's the same thing. But what I want to show you is that in actual fact, the cost of rendering each document from one language into all the others is huge, because it must be translated into all the others, and so it's a huge quantity of interactive translation, even if this to allow that all the languages of the United Nations be used in equal measure for the work being done at the United Nations. Therefore, it's extremely expensive, and if we move on to the EU, where there are 26 countries, these pairs that we have is 30, that would move up to, in Europe, it moves up to 380 language pairs for translation. So think of the cost of this. And this is an obligation. According to the founding charter of the UN and the EU, all languages must be treated equally. But if we are only working with 6 official languages, if we didn't have these 6 languages, we wouldn't be respecting diversity and addressing the whole world. Because even with these 6 languages, these are the most spoken languages in the world. But there's no German here, for example, which is a very important economic power. There's no Japanese here. There's no Hindi here. There's no African language here, and so on and so forth. Interactive translation in our system, as we call it, universal networking language, UNL. This allows us for, instead of doing a translation one language to one language, we produce digital content by which the expression of knowledge is done in numerical form, digitally, and converted to this electronic language, which is the universal networking language, which is quite simply a character that the computer understands, because computers don't understand ABC, they understand digits.
They don't understand the Chinese writing, but they transform that into digits. Computers, they understand music. So if it can convert the sense of the words and not the characters, then it will end up understanding the semantics which is expressed through these different languages. And in that way, it would be able to translate it into other languages. And I believe that the digital expression of knowledge has as a main inspiration, it's not an inspiration, but I would say that it is similar to what Rosetta was to the understanding of the Egyptian civilization, because you used to have the Greek characters and the hieroglyphs, and it was possible to identify and to start to understand because the texts were the same texts, but the characters were different. Rosetta today, the numerical representation, if we want to use the analogy, we will have the same function, because if a Chinese or Arab expression is done in the same way as a Portuguese or French expression. For the computer is going to be able to understand the difference between a hot dog and dog through that, and it won't actually mix up food with animals. And this UNL system will be able to go into depth into that. This is a language that the computer is able to understand, and it allows the computer to understand the natural languages with whatever characters may be. But with the development of the interfaces, here, very briefly, there is a dictionary, there is a grammar, there is a generation system that transforms natural language into electronic representation, digital representation, and then another software that will do the other way around. And here we have the specifications for the three elements. So we have the syntaxes, the semantics, and the lexicon. And to speak about that, I just would mention that you can practically imagine a text, because through this software and grammar dictionaries, we have an ensemble of elements that reside in the computer and that end up understanding what is expressed in Latin characters and in Arabic or Chinese. It will understand it in the same way, but there is a dictionary that will understand the lexicon and the semantics. And through a software, it will be transformed into a digital representation. It is like a photograph, like a negative. And this digital document then may be reconverted into the natural languages through the internet. It may be reconverted into whatever language that may have developed interface. In order to do that, you will have need the dictionary, the grammars, a basis of knowledge. So this basis of knowledge consists in what we have in each one of our cultures or individual heads. We have a semantic world, the whole semantic world that started in the first seconds of life until today. It is forming a semantic background, and this background the computer needs to acquire, and this is fed. We have, that means hundreds of years, but slowly it will acquire its recognition capacity. All this is work on the internet. It uses the existing system, and we develop a network of servers in different languages. We have 15 languages that started this work. Some are more advanced than others. The theoretical capacity it means that we need to encompass an unlimited number of languages. So we won't have, the question will be the capacity of the available network. I'm going to stop here because I have a continuity, and Professor Hanad is going to show this representation and how this language, which is the language of computers, can work to interact with human language. I thank you very much.
Nós agradecemos a participação.
We'd like the participation of Professor Patassis de la Senta, and I would like to invite Dr. Ronaldo Martins, who will speak about the project Brazil UNDL. Good afternoon. I would like to thank the invitation. I would like to apologize because I thought that my presentation would be in English. That's why all my slides are in English. But I will speak in Portuguese. The idea of this presentation would be to give you a more concrete idea of the universal network language with which we have been working for the last 10 years in Brazil. In order to understand that, it would be interesting to understand two key concepts. The one, it's a concept of language. The second is a concept of information. And the idea is how to see how the UNDL deals with those frontiers based on two problems or projects. One, together with UNESCO, and the most recently one, recent one with the IBICT. In order to be able to start, it would be interesting to observe here that the concept of language, at least as how we understand it in our everyday lives, reveals the simplicity of the phenomenon that has been identified and researched by linguists. Basically, we need a speaker, and usually the idea of a listener, the existence of the world about which we are speaking, the idea of an aboutness of the language, of course, the idea of the language itself. So we know that in the classical communication theory, which was built after the 40s, this speaker maintains some sort of contact with his listener and has some sort of idea of about the world, which is materialized through language, recorded in a message that will be circulated to this other listener. And this listener with the same code would be able to reach the same idea of world that was conceived by the speaker. This is more or less the concept, the context of many myths and folklores about language. But those myths, they are quite problematic if we take our data into account, and that to a certain extent will show that language won't necessarily mean communication as such. If we consider, for example, the vocabulary that is available in Portuguese and Brazilian Portuguese for what we actually see here on the screen, we will notice that we have a very expressive ensemble of different words. So these forms were all taken from the Weiss dictionary. All of them are synonyms for money. Here, for example, you see all the different synonyms. Very well, many different synonyms. If the objective of the language was only to have communication, why would we need to have a variety? Wouldn't it be much more logical to have a convergence of to just one word? Why do we need so many different forms? Why do speakers insist in using different words for the same object? Why do they use a very idiosyncratic way, a very peculiar way that to express something that perhaps would be much simpler if that had been done in a homogenized way? So this is the question that is raised, and we must discuss this case like myself. And we question about, is language really does it really serve communication? Behind this idea of communication, what we realize is that there are many other factors. This idea that the speaker and the listener are in fact interrelated by some sort of contact or channel is not necessarily true. In the majority of the case, they compete for the right of speaking, for the space. And this interaction is not always cooperative for the floor. So frequently the speaker says what the listener doesn't want to listen to, and the listener only listens to what he wants to hear. So we have many different questions that create a problem of the existence of this contact in this channel. And the idea that this speaker who speaks is not unique, is not one. He might be divided. Sometimes we say something that we didn't want to say. Behind our speech, there is some other way of saying things, and frequently we just say what our social class actually allows us to say. We also have an ideology that speaks through us, meaning frequently we don't speak like as such, but we are spoken by the language. So we're not effectively the origin of the communication, but only part of this process. And furthermore, I think that language has nothing to do with nomenclature. Words are not just labels that we stick on things. The words recreate things in their way, and then, of course, we have a projection that won't always be transparent or identical in the way that the world is organized. There is an opacity of the language that obstructs our way of actually being able to speak about the world, and this provokes all the numerous problems that we have been facing.
So there's a number of issues which indicate that language is not actually a means of communication. It is more an identity tool. We present ourselves, we express ourselves through language. we use language as this tool. We use language to get the behavior that we want from other people, and this behavior is not as disinterested as it might appear also if it were just seen as language. Now, for the universe of languages and not just different variations of the same language, this raises a number of other issues. For example, we know that no matter what organization we're talking about, it is going to be affected by two different languages. So language A, if language A is used by one group, language B will probably doesn't use it in that way. So if we have mapping of different languages, first it's going to stop translatability to be identity. So the fact that two languages can be translated one to another does not mean that the statements will be the same or identical in those two languages. And you can't say that difference means a lack. Because one of the ideas of multilingualism is that different languages have different ways of talking about the same thing without there being a loss of content or a hierarchy. So there are different ways of expressing things in different languages. They will have different vocabularies, different syntax. In both cases, then, they are ways of talking about the world, and these ways cannot be value judged. And without this, then we reach the third statement, which is what we're really interested in, that no particular language can cope with the entire diversity of the world. So, however wide-ranging it is, however expansive its vocabulary is, however little it is now belongs to another particular nation, so however much it may be of lingua franca, for example, English, this language will not be able to cope with all the cultural diversity of the human race, which is why we must fight to make sure that all languages can be expressed in one way. Evidently, we may lose diversity through this, but if proposing another language, it's something that always raises resistance, and there have been unsuccessful projects in the past. So the first thing is that we need to think of a language that in Leibniz in the 18th century, he was one of the inventors of language, and mathematics would be one of the written language, a written basis for language. So this is what he was working on, a written language that could be read by everybody in their own language. So this passigraphy is what we're talking about here. So the idea of the project is this, and this is the basis for what we're talking about more specifically now. So one of the aims in this idea is to formulate something that we're calling UNL, which is Universal Networking Language. So this originally was used for translation, but from early on it was perceived that it could be useful for representing knowledge. In Brazil, at least, we've been working very hard to use it to represent knowledge than actually for translation, because we think only when we've got a large enough body of information will we be able to produce quality translations using this tool. It started in 1996. It first started at the United Nations University. This is an advanced study university. It became independent in 2000, and now it's being led by the UNDL Foundation in Geneva. Since then, it's been used by different teams in Brazil. It's been developed by two groups, one from the University of São Paulo and one of São Carlos, and one is the NDL Institute in Santa Catarina State in the south. And this is a representation of it, so it's a semantic network here. So here are the concepts represented by nodes within a reticulate structure. The information that is not actually autonomous concepts, they use attributes, or attributes that are given for each node, and these are related by semantic labeled connections. So for a computer, that's represented in a different way. So this is what you saw there. This is written down now inside the machine, like this. So this is the way that UNL is coded, encoded. So this is part of the automatic translation, because the first idea was direct translation between the source and target languages. This was sort of word-for-word translation that we still find on the internet, and they produce very odd, cranky translations. And those were first developed in the 1950s, but it's clear the limitations that they have, and now there are more developed ones that do syntax analysis. So you get a syntax analysis between two languages, but this is also limited, and now we have semantic analysis between languages, and these are the most sophisticated ones that are used, but most of these are not available for large-scale users because they work in corpora and specific data sets. And at the top of this is UNL, because it's not a different level of syntax or semantic analysis, but it's a way of representing natural languages in a simple, one single way. This is an old dream. This is based on the Vauquois triangle. This is one of the He was working in the 60s and 70s in France, working on automatic languages, and he understood this idea of increasing complexity. And thus we would stop having lots of language pairs, and we would start to have a more integrated project. This conception was seen as a utopia. And this of course has to do with the Tower of Babel, because so far we haven't managed to create this perfect language that can encompass and englobe all natural languages and say everything that all natural languages say. And this is the limitation that we in this project are tackling. But basically, the idea is being developed on the internet. There are lots of similarities with web semantics. Web semantics tries to set up relationships between two URIs. These are identifiers of sources. So these generate metadata, for example, the author. It works so that the previous language was criticized because it was monolinguistic. It was only one language, and that was English. So you would use doubling core, which basically represents the concepts involved in the meta library of English. And it would only offer metadata. This is data about the language, but not information from the text. And this is what we're trying to overcome in UNL. So we're not using source unifiers, we're using universal words. And we link these concepts using relationships that have more content than in the semantic web. So this is one way for the way that we're trying to handle or tackle the limitations found in this previous language. And we don't want to just have metadata, but actually represent the data itself. And of course, we need to work hard before we reach this goal. But there are a number of other factors which make this very important. One is that it's computationability. It can be interacted on the computer. It can be programmed. And also, it's cost-effective, because if we take a long time to code a language in UNL, it might be more work than that we use to do a translation. It's much quickly and it's more effective, and then it will be understood in all other languages. Also, it's more robust. It's not based on a limited set of information. It tries to cover all kinds of knowledge and not just one particular area. And also, it impacts the whole idea of multilingualism. So, and this is all languages, not just primary languages. It's also elastic in the sense that it has space, it's flexible, there's space for it to have added creations, it's defined through this, and it's open as well. It can be used by everybody, and it's neutral in the sense that it's not committed to one particular language. It encompasses all languages, but it isn't a language for people, it's a language for computers. The representation of this language, if we want to work with it, it's interesting to understand that representation of information is important, but there are other issues and other uses for UNL that can be set off so that we can add new knowledge as we move in this direction. So organization, the retrieval and extraction of information, as well as its inference. So these are all included in the project so that we can deal with information not only multilingual, but also monolingual information. And we're going to be talking about the organization of multilingual information in this project. But to talk about this, we need to understand that the second word is information, and this is what's important. We would like information to be simple, but of course it isn't. We would like it to be standardized, but of course it isn't. We would love information to be organized, but it isn't. We would love information to be more objective, but it isn't. We would like it to be more concrete, more linked to reality, to the concrete world, but it isn't. And maybe we'd like it to be more structured, but it isn't. It's anarchical, and it's confusing, and it will probably always be too much and over the top. So this is an issue that we must talk about, because we cannot tame information. It's not possible to put information in the same way that it's put on the internet. So taking this as our premise, this is one of the aims of our project. So, as we've already heard today, the Society of Information does not coincide with the Knowledge Society, which actually, because there are a number of problems in knowledge production. For example, there's a problem of the reliability or credibility of knowledge, the scale and extent of this knowledge, that it can increase continually, accessibility and diversity, and its coherence. So this huge amount of information tends to stagnate the information and makes it impossible, actually, for us to use it effectively. And so often, we put documents on the internet. I mean, we have to put, for example, theses and dissertations on the internet. These are important, but putting them on the internet isn't enough. We shouldn't just shove them there, because we must organize them in a way that they can be accessed in a way. And this is why we have this partnership set up. One example of this is EOLS, which is an encyclopedia organized as part of a UNESCO system. It has more than 200 volumes, more than 250,000 pages. It's going to be multidisciplinary. And here we can see the encyclopedia. So the information is organized. You can search for information. We've got a summary for each article. And then it gives us related chapters and a number of other pieces of information that are interconnected amongst themselves. There are suggested reading. So there's a huge amount of information, so much that it becomes impossible to use it, because this is too much information. So anybody who's tried to use this realizes that. Because, for example, let's think about just articles on water. If we go into the table of contents, there are 229,000 plus titles on water. Who's going to read all of those to decide which one they want to read? So we can't use a tree browsing method. And then there's a taxonomy created by the author, because the users have different ways of expressing themselves. Of course, we could use the system's own source search mechanism. But if we often get more than 5,000 or thousands and thousands of results, and we only look at the first few pages that are better known, and the information isn't always what we need in those pages, and there's also no ranking going on in the search results. And there's also the issue. So these are issues that we think we can approach, and we want to organize them. So we set up this AELS project, and we got all the metadata from it, and we organized it in a sort of huge network, more than 29,000 titles, more than 4,000 authors, and so on and so forth. And we translated all this into UML, and we developed a graphic interface to display the data, and we also developed a search system. But it continued to be a little confusing, but we worked with this encyclopedia from a different perspective as a network. So this is pretty much how it is. This is all its articles and all its potential. I know that you can't read it from where you are. But anyway, we're navigating as if we were in a tree. But here we can find other stuff. What's in purple? Those are keywords. So on the right hand, you can see if we click on a keyword, we can have definitions of the keywords, and we can also see yellow. Those are the authors, and we can see data on the authors and the texts that they have written. And so it's a number of ways, functionalities that we have managed to do by organizing this data and translating it into UNL, and this translation of this metadata is our aim. And this is our current state. So this is how far we've got in the project. And phase two, we've developed an explore tool. We've developed a discovery tool. These are the graphs. And we can search for information in a less organized way. And we've also got a search engine that produces the search results in a more user-friendly way. But now we're going to try and improve the search system, and we're going to make the metadata multilingual. And then, of course, multilingualize the data itself. And another interesting one is the theses and dissertations digital library. We heard about this in the morning. This was organized by the IBICT from data that was provided by universities. So it indexed all the metadata. User accesses the information. The information is not kept with IBICT, but IBICT just organizes it. And then it sends the user to wherever it is stored. So this is an advanced search system. You can use by author, topic, title, and so forth. The results are shown this way. This is a results page. And we can select one, and then we get some information, the metadata on the text, author, title, institution, abstract, contributors, topics, and the library in which it is kept. And then there are a number of issues related to this. There are over 60,000 titles, so it's too much information if just expressed ordinarily. So we have a search engine, but we can only look by topic, author, subject, institution, library, and abstract. We cannot rank the results, so they appear in a plain flat list. We can't navigate through the results. We can't have a table of contents of the results, whether it's organized by taxonomy or any other way. And there's no interlinking of the articles. We don't have hyperlinks between dissertations and theses until we reach the one that we want. So data is, each one is separate and encapsulated and not linked up. And with the exception of a few fields, the information is provided by institutions in only one language, that is Portuguese. So the idea of the project is that we do with this what we've done with EOIS. So we are now setting up a network to link up all the metadata and present this as a network to the user so that they can navigate through it as a network, and then we're going to be multilingualizing it. So this is the proposal here that we have put forward to EBICT, and now we're taking these forward, and this is proof that we can indeed make things work in a less monolinguic or monolingual-centric way and take things forward in a more pluralistic way.
I would like to thank Dr. Romero Martins, and would like to invite Dr. Nargi Nargi. We invite him to make his conference on multilingual access to library information, the approach of the Library of Alexandria.
I would like to thank the committee.
Eu gostaria de agradecer o comitê que me convidou, e eu estou muito agradecido por poder apresentar o trabalho da Biblioteca de Alexandria. Eu falarei principalmente sobre a biblioteca, o sistema de informações de bibliotecas online, também a Biblioteca Digital Mundial, o DLF, o projeto de livros MEN, La Main à la Pâte, o Gateway do Banco Mundial, e basicamente nós estamos trabalhando em alguns projetos
que são related to multilingualism somehow. I start with the old library. The old library should it looked like that. There are some drawings about it. And the library had already 700,000 scrolls, and they are arranged in racks. And actually, Callimachus Pinnakis. Callimachus Pinnakis was the first one that had actually cataloged the scrolls there. And at the end, when I show you the projects that we have done, and if you agree to them, so I try to change my name to Callimachus the Second, but if you agree on what if you are going to do is good, at least in UNL. actually they remain physically, but it lives in all the mind of the people. This is an old library. The new library is an architectural masterpiece with the largest reading hall, which actually can have up to 2,000 readers at the same time. It's the same area. And Biblioteca Alexandria goals are to be windows on Egypt for the world, window on the world for Egypt. And the third one is a leading institution of the digital age. The fourth one naturally is a cultural center and cultural exchange between individuals and civilizations.
Para poder escolher a importância do ICT na biblioteca, nós temos um setor especial, e esses setores daqui estão centrados nessa região. Nós temos os serviços bibliotecários, nós temos a parte acadêmica e o ICT. Todos os projetos são feitos dentro da Biblioteca da Alexandria, são feitos sob o ISIS. Nós temos fóruns e institutos, e um deles é ISIS, que é a Escola Internacional de Ciências da Informação. Não é uma verdadeira escola onde você poderá conseguir um diploma, mas é apenas uma forma de acomodar todos os projetos da própria biblioteca. E nós nos comprometemos em oferecer acesso a todas as informações a todas as pessoas em qualquer momento. Aqui nós temos a biblioteca UML, esse sistema de informação, que começou praticamente um ano e meio atrás, e é um curso de formação superior, dura mais de 2 anos, e aqui nós temos o sistema atual, é um sistema de informação bibliotecária, onde você poderá, por exemplo, encontrar um livro, fazer uma pesquisa de um por autor, ou por editora, ou pelo título do livro. Nós aqui temos uma introdução ao sistema. E aqui, essa é a nota de busca. E você poderá fazer o seu pedido na sua língua. E nós temos a mesma interface árabe. Isso é obrigatório, e nós vamos ver uma romance de Nadine Afonso, o nome é Sokira Maria, e aqui, quem autorizou o romance Esocareia? Você pode, claro, que também perguntar quem é o autor do Esocareia, e assim por diante. De qualquer forma, você pode fazer a pergunta que quiser e você terá a resposta. Se você quiser saber sobre a biografia de Mahfouz, você pode ter em árabe, em inglês, em japonês, em chinês e indonésio. Essas são as línguas que nós temos e estamos trabalhando com algumas delas. Com uma versão de 6 meses e alguns dos centros online ainda não terminaram o seu processo de tradução. Então, por exemplo, se nós passarmos para o chinês, nós vamos nos deparar com um texto em inglês, porque não poderá ser utilizado utilizando uma versão atual chinesa. Antes de terminar, eu gostaria de chamar a atenção para o fato de que tudo que vocês viram até agora, não está escrito em inglês, em árabe, nem em qualquer língua, está escrito em UML. O banco de dados está em UML. E o segundo projeto na Biblioteca Digital Mundial, que foi o protótipo desse projeto e que foi anunciado há 4 meses atrás na Unesco, e foi iniciado pelo pela Biblioteca do Congresso para poder coletar todos os materiais mais valiosos de forma a colocá-los de uma forma eletrônica. E nós estamos cooperando para poder construir o sistema, a infraestrutura e também as ferramentas de busca para as diferentes línguas. Nós também estamos fazendo a mesma coisa para a Biblioteca Digital Mundial. Muito bem. Nós temos um projeto europeu que está um pouco atrasado. E esse projeto daqui, ele também funcionará em 6 línguas oficiais da UNESCO e português. Aqui nós temos a federação que tem uma parceria entre bibliotecas acadêmicas e outras organizações que foi fundada em 1995 e que opera sob a aspiração do Conselho de Bibliotecas e de Recursos de Informação. Tem 34 parceiros, 5 aliados. Deveria poder identificar as normas e coordenar os pesquisadores para poder adiantar grandes projetos. Aqui nós nos associamos em 2005. Nós somos a segunda biblioteca a se associar. A primeira é a British Library. Nós estamos fazendo parte do Amelian Project e a missão desse projeto é poder criar uma biblioteca universal que possa incentivar a criatividade e oferecer acesso a todo o conhecimento humano. E o primeiro passo é ter um sistema que funciona 24 horas por dia, 7 dias por semana, com 1 milhão de livros nos primeiros 3 anos, e que deveria chegar a 10 milhões de anos nos próximos 10 anos. E o projeto de longo prazo é poder digitalizar esses 10 milhões de livros em 10 anos, 1 milhão, ou menos de 1% de todos os livros que foram publicados. Os parceiros nos Estados Unidos, na Carnegie University e Internet Archive, e na China, nós temos 2 universidades da China e da Índia, mais de 28 centros. O processo é de seleção de livros, escaneamento e a publicação dessa seleção de livros, que será feita através dos metadados. Nós temos o processo de scanning e também tem uma forma de publicação utilizando PDF ou para outras formas também. La main à la pâte é uma expressão, um projeto entre os franceses e os árabes, que foi organizado por Georges Charpak, que ganhou o prêmio Nobel em 92, e que foi feito para ajudar os professores, principalmente para os estudantes do primeiro grau, a estudar ciências. E baseado na sua experiência, ele vai facilitar aos professores como eles poderão coletar os materiais científicos. E, claro, esse site também vai funcionar 24 horas, 7 vezes por dia, por semana, claro, porque faz parte da internet. Aqui nós temos nossos parceiros. Nós temos apenas a tradução e a equalização, por exemplo. Estão falando a respeito, por exemplo, de um livro eletrônico. Nenhum egípcio vai poder compreender o que isso significa. Aqui nós temos um site em francês. Aqui nós temos a estrutura do site e o mesmo site em árabe. E o gateway de desenvolvimento É outro sistema que é feito junto com o Banco Mundial, através do qual você vai traduzir o seu portal para o árabe, uma tradução bilíngue. Nós temos também o portal interativo do Banco Mundial, temos várias informações, principalmente a respeito de projetos de desenvolvimento. Esse é o propósito, é poder oferecer informações para os países em desenvolvimento para poder aumentar a habilidade, principalmente do setor público, em poder reagir às necessidades do mercado. Na primeira fase, nós deveríamos conseguir uma tradução, nós deveríamos traduzir o portal de desenvolvimento. Na segunda fase, nós vamos construir um portal com o conteúdo árabe, talvez mesmo egípcio. E aqui nós temos os parceiros, aqueles que nos ajudam no desenvolvimento desse portal. Aqui nós temos o site propriamente dito, do World Bank Gateway, outro projeto que não é bilíngue, eu diria que é bilíngue, de certa forma. Nós temos jornais do Oriente Médio que são catalogados e são publicados por diferentes instituições e universidades, tanto nos países árabes, nos Estados Unidos e na França. É uma iniciativa da Yale University e o próximo passo foi a fase seguinte ao projeto OASIS. E o projeto começou em outubro de 2005 e foi financiado por mais de 4 anos. Os parceiros são a Yale University. Aqui nós temos também a Universitätsbibliothek de Sachsen, da Alemanha. Nós temos também o Justin, dos Estados Unidos, os editores. Os parceiros devem desenvolver e inserir informação no sistema com a maior quantidade de multilinguismo possível, pelo menos em 6 ou 7 línguas. Nós temos outro projeto também, que é a digitalização de livros de árabe, não apenas livros árabes, mas livros também escritos em várias línguas, mas relacionados aos países árabes. O projeto foi iniciado em cooperação com a Stanford University e a conferência foi organizada para preparar o início do projeto, e Google deveria apoiar o projeto, porém parece que eles têm algumas limitações, principalmente eles têm algumas questões relacionadas à propriedade intelectual. Aqui nós temos a página. O objetivo é poder desenvolver um esforço de cooperação internacional para poder assegurar uma digitalização útil e eficaz de livros árabes ou relacionados à língua árabe. Nós pedimos financiamentos. Os financiamentos deveriam chegar daqui a 6 meses e vamos começar uma digitalização maciça. Aqui nós temos os parceiros, Stanford University, Yale University e o Centro Einstein, que são os grandes contribuidores. Nós temos também aqueles contribuidores potenciais, como Princeton University, McGill University, Dar el-Kutub, que também é a Biblioteca Nacional do Egito e assim por diante. Qual o plano de trabalho antecipado? Nós já temos um protótipo para o projeto, onde cada instituição vai injetar o conteúdo, seu conteúdo ao banco de dados. Ele será escaneado, os livros escaneados, e que será traduzido para diferentes línguas, e principalmente para o árabe. Como eu mencionei, o site ISIS é um projeto também muito importante. Aqui nós temos o site, se vocês quiserem ter acesso a outros projetos e quiserem dar uma olhada mais aproximada dos projetos que estamos fazendo, por favor, acessem esse site. E como eu disse, nós nos comprometemos com acesso universal a todo conhecimento para todos em todos os momentos. Muito obrigado. Eu esqueci de mostrar um slide muito interessante.
I'm a grandfather since.
Eu sou um avô há 18 meses. É um momento.
Thank you very much.
Muito obrigada.
Bom, agradecemos.
I would like to thank for the speech of Dr. Nadir. I believe that many people are interested in asking questions, I suppose. So I propose to open the floor for a debate.
Gilda Queiroz. Alô?
Não.
Está aberto? Está funcionando? Bem. Gilda Queiroz.
Gilda Queiroz. From the Apsis, from the
linguagem.
That language will be a language for people, but for computers, the UNL. What do you mean exactly? If every language, if the interface is an interface between a human language and another human language, so what does it mean to say that a language is not a language for people? For human beings. I believe that there are many ways of answering this question, and the simplest would be to try to understand in this language some sort of a language that would be spoken by machines in a very similar sense to the way that people speak human language. And in the last instance, what we try to do, but we try to do in different places, is this Prometheus gesture of giving fire to the machine, of teaching the machine to speak. And we believe to a certain extent that the machine is not going to speak whilst we try to mechanize our language, because this human language has many different premises that are and takes for granted many things that the machine won't be able to do. So there are possibilities like, or there's one possibility for the machine to build this way to interact and to represent what we actually do with language, or there will be no possibility of actually being able to use the machine as a in this process. So when I speak that this is not a language for human beings, nobody is going to speak a UNL. It's not an Esperanto. like many artificial languages that have been proposed during history. Now, this is some sort of representation which works exactly with the machine that would allow the machine to be able to take some of the decisions that we take when we actually speak. If in automatic translation, there is a frequent saying that says the planes, they don't move their wings. When men tried to imitate birds, they did manage to create a plane. So when they stopped imitating birds, they managed to create something else and they produced an airplane. So you are able to create the same result, but based on a completely different representation. So what we want is for you to put a text for a machine and later on you will have the text back in a different language. And for you not to be able to see any difference between this text translated by the machine and the text translated by a human translator. Of course, this is a utopia, but this is our last objective. So in this case, what the machine used to produce this behavior that is so human, so truly human, which is translation, will be a language, but a language that we cannot speak and that we don't understand. It was conceived in order for the machine to be able to develop that activity that we develop in other ways. In that sense, I don't know whether I messed you even more up.
Thank you very much.
Part of my question perhaps has been answered by what you just mentioned, but I have been following the translation online systems since they actually started in 1995. I would like to say that there has been a great effort. They continue to be disappointing. And I believe this disappointment is going to continue during many years. But in fact, I never had heard about what actually was presented here today. I would like to know, because I understand that there is an attempt of transforming language, and you compared it, for example, with maths. And I believe that even maths doesn't express, even though math may be quite precise, it doesn't express the sense in the same way. For example, number 100 can be a lot or less. It really depends on what we're talking about. So even though this may be a precise representation of units, the sense of the information depends on the context that we're talking about. So what I would like to hear about is, given the fact that in order to have these practices, how do we feel today? Do we feel that we are getting near that project, that reality? How will the system will actually feed from the cultural experience that actually give a sense to what we say? For example, if I say something like that, this wouldn't be perhaps a solution, chasing with a dog, but chasing with a cat. So it will need a lot of cultural knowledge for people to be able to understand what is said and translate into a different language, probably. Someone from a different language and they're able to understand information I want to translate, because information is in the cultural experience and of the language. And how can this translation system that we want to propose here can allow for those who see a translated text to have the same experience, cultural experience that probably a human translator would be able to try and give? Perhaps he won't be able to give it, but probably he would have many more elements to be able to do it, because he will know the different cultural elements that are involved in the culture. So perhaps, are we getting near to this translation system? Are we approaching the possibility of having the same experience? Because sometimes when we listen to translations that are done by human beings, we are disappointed. We understand that the human expects exactly the message that I wanted to say. And to which extent will the computer be able to do that? And perhaps with a higher precision of what we actually want to have. Thank you.
Well, I think you're talking about two things. Well, maybe I'll be a bit more discouraged than you are, because we started in the 90s. There was a fare system. We started in 1950s. Automatic translation was money was thrown at this area in the 1960s in the US. So a lot of what is done in non-numeric computation went into automatic translation, and we know the results of this. So there's no system so wide encompassing as ours. But there are other interesting systems. There's a very good one for French-English weather forecasts. And in the night, there was developed in the 1970s by Montreal in Canada. But they couldn't get a translator to do it because they had a number that they kept firing 2 or 3, 4 months because the texts were so large and so boring. And so they mechanized the process, and it works until this day. And in Switzerland, we have one that translates avalanche reports in the four languages of Switzerland. So this works perfectly well, but it's quite different to translate a weather report or an avalanche report and translate anything else. So, of course, we've got very localized results, and we've got very good systems and very successful systems. We've got localization systems, and companies use this to translate large quantities of text. But when we think about automatic translation, we think about translating a man for a machine. But what we're talking about is something less. There are three paradigms in artificial intelligence, if this is what we're talking about. One of these, the most ambitious one, is to substitute person for machine. But there's another one where you should just accelerate what humans already do. And the third is to expand the human's capacity. So, if you have a search system like Google, Yahoo, or any other, it improves humans' capacity to search for information. We would be incapable of, in such a short space of time, being able to find the information, to consult all those bases of information. So, this is an acceleration of existing behavior. Now, many translation tools use this. They do this. So, for example, translation memory does this. You retranslate what you've already done. So, translators don't produce inconsistencies in the same text. They're always going to be using the same translations. There are a number of systems for this, and which are in these two lines. So we've got man-helped automatic translation or human translation helped by a machine. So the translator is the person, but the machine helps. And these are considered stages until maybe in the distant future, our ultimate aim, which is to substitute people for machines. So it's really what you expect of translation, what do you think of translation. In Brazil, what we're doing is saying, well, it's impossible. In the short term, we can translate with a good translation from one language to another language using UNL. So we need to do it. First of all, we need to get a translation from English or Portuguese into UNL. That's already a large job. So we translate into UNL. And once it's in UNL, we automatically generate the other text to other languages. Because the generation after that is easy, because the difficult stage is the analysis. So say you'd say, well, what I've got, a cat or a dog or whatever, then things are, it's a different concept. So in UNL, once it's in UNL, then it's easy, because it's a language which isn't ambiguous. But then there's the other issue of mathematics, the ambiguity of signs and so forth. This is the interesting side of maths, actually, because no matter what language you're talking about, because 1 + 1 in English, French, or Portuguese is not different in words, but once it's in a formula, it's the same. So we know that we have formula connotations and so forth, but you can, in maths, it's always going to be the same. But this hasn't stopped maths from being a sort of master line for all the positive sciences, so the sort of the foundation, the basis for all sciences. So this, their existence has never made maths unfeasible. So by using it, language in this way, it's not making natural languages unnatural. So this is our case when we talk about organizing information, for instance. Because at this stage we're working on at that level. We're adding knowledge, vocabulary, creating simple grammar rules, and then we can create interesting, useful tools, and we can navigate while using them. And then one day in the future we'll have so much information that maybe we can get better translations. But at this moment, it's a completely different concept for a translation. But now we're still at the bottom of that triangle that we saw in the presentation, because the costs for the basic research are so high that there's nobody that's going to foot the bill at this point in time. I'd like to make the most of the presence of Professor Maggie here and to make a comment and to ask a question. From what I heard, I've heard today, one of the great possibilities for UNL is its resources. In other words, using a source language, you can go to the program that encodes the UNL, and then you have an initial outcome, and then you can use recursive factor on this, and you can multiply it different ways. This is one side of the issue. The other side, which I think is very exciting, is that in the projects mentioned, we're talking about the manipulation of non-Latin language scripts. In other words, Arabic to English, English to Arabic, and this adds certain sophistication, particularly in the Alexandria Library project. So I'd like to ask two things. One, if there are indicators, numerical indicators, of to show the quality of the translated text, does it increase? Does it get better if you have more resources? How has this worked in the Alexandrian Library? And the other issue is, how has this impacted costs, given the sophistication of the projects that have been presented? Oh, and one more thing. Well, anything else that he can talk about the library would be very interesting to hear about, particularly the methodology and the technology using UNL. Na verdade, como falou, a codificação é muito mais fácil. Desculpe, é mais difícil do que a decodificação. E estamos tendo muita dificuldade com a árabe, principalmente porque você pode ter, por exemplo, uma palavra ligada sim. Então, você pode ter uma palavra que representa mais que uma palavra em inglês. Por exemplo, se a gente diz and my book, isso é uma palavra em árabe. E, às vezes, você não pode, não dá para entender só pela palavra, se é uma palavra ou se é o and ligado à palavra ou se é só parte. Enfim. Por exemplo, meu livro e seu livro é, na verdade, uma palavra só em árabe. E a palavra o ou a também fica ligado à palavra principal, ao substantivo. Então, por exemplo, e o livro seria uma palavra só, que começa com E, aí tem o e tem livro, três palavras em inglês. E isso está dificultando o processo de compreender o sentido da palavra. E então é muito difícil responder a sua pergunta com árabe, é muito complicado. Por si só, isso não é um problema, mas a maneira que normalmente se escreve árabe agora desviou de árabe tradicional. E isso passou a ser uma prática comum. Então, por exemplo, em francês, Zansangue se omite, mas muitas vezes a mesma coisa acontece em árabe, com alguns caracteres. E agora está ficando comum nos jornais é que normalmente a gente não escreve isso em árabe.
E para compreender se o Alexandre Guy é ele ou não, isso é muito difícil. E existe uma questão de ambiguidade e, de certa maneira, a ambiguidade ela sempre está presente. É um princípio da tradução. Para um projeto UDNL, que é conduzido na Biblioteca de Alexandria, nós temos um centro nós estamos bem, e nós esperamos isso. Nós estamos trazendo textos selecionados e nós sabemos em que direção ir. E por causa desse projeto, nós começamos a fazer isso e acreditamos que, ao terminar a primeira fase, nós teremos um decodificador de alguma forma. Eu não sei se isso será materializado ou não, mas daqui a uns 6 meses eu devo dar uma resposta a vocês. Eu gostaria de assinalar também em relação à tradução que o novo projeto do WGL, que começou há 6 meses atrás, só coletou 261 itens. E o tempo gasto não foi na coleta, e sim, 50% do tempo foi gasto dedicando-se a metadata dos outros 50 apenas com a tradução e a verificação da própria tradução. Eles não tinham como fazer mais do que isso em 6 meses, 261 itens. E quem conduziu o projeto foi a North Congress, que é tem uma grande capacidade, um grande potencial para fazer esse trabalho. E se vocês observarem, vocês virem principalmente a tradução do árabe, vocês não vão ficar satisfeitos com essa tradução. porque havia muitos estrangeiros que traduziram livros para árabe. Ou árabes que viveram durante 20 anos, uns 40 anos, agora estão nos Estados Unidos, e eles podem dar um ou outro jornal, e é tudo. Então, a dificuldade em si reside principalmente nessas 100 linhas, foi a tradução. 50% disso foi, pelo menos, a tradução.
Mais alguma pergunta?
Any further questions? We would like to thank the presence of for coming, and I will close this session. Thank you very much indeed.
Gostaria de fazer um comunicado que as palestras que aconteceram aqui hoje estarão de...
Would like to inform you that all conferences from here will be on the side of the EBICT.
Repito,
www.ebict.br/Alert Plus. On Monday, we will have this information available. Thank you very much.
Tem que ser para um outro que está entrando na área, porque ele está muito interessado nisso. Vamos fazer a justiça, então.
Tem cura.
Sim. Miranda, casa dele já aí.
Hoje, já foi embora amanhã de manhã. E a gente
Eu não sei se eu vou fazer uma coisa assim. Thank you.